Welcome to this week's Innovation Forum podcast for Friday 7th December with me, Ian Welsh. Coming up is our usual news digest and details of what we're up to. Plus, when I was in Detroit recently, I spoke with David Chalouskas, Director of Sustainability at General Motors, about the potential for a zero emissions future for personal transportation. And following Innovation Forum's recent Business and Human Rights Conference in London, I caught up with unseen CEO Andrew Wallace to reflect on changing corporate modern slavery risks. Before that, though, some exciting news about this podcast. To celebrate our 50,000th download, which we've just passed this week, we've got a special December offer for podcast listeners of 10% off passes to any of Innovation Forum's upcoming events. That's on top of any other discount. Just use code IFPOD10, that's IFPOD10, at the online checkout. Coming up now, though, is our weekly review of some of what's happening in business and sustainability. Corporate action on climate change has been front and centre the past few weeks, not least because of the COP24 talks ongoing at the moment in Poland. The number of investors divesting from fossil fuels and from companies refusing to take their climate change obligations seriously continues to rise. Perhaps it's no coincidence that oil giant Shell has announced plans to link senior executive remuneration to progress the company makes towards reducing its emissions. Shell has made commitments to reduce the carbon footprint of its energy products by 20% through to 2035 and by 50% by 2050. Even more, Shell has said it will set short-term targets at least every 5 years from 2020, which are the specific measures against which senior management will be assessed. The company plans to have third-party verification of its progress against targets that ensure transparency for stakeholders and will report each year on progress. And it will strive to set a science-based target in line with the Paris Accord's 2 Celsius global warming goal. Whether or not 2 Celsius is sufficient to counter the worst impacts of climate change is, of course, now open to question. An environmental activist will always want more, but Shell's new strategy does feel like an indication of a real shift in corporate attitudes to climate change. The potential impact of business for the human rights risks associated with climate change has been highlighted by a new report from the World Health Organization and the World Bank, along with 150 experts from 25 other universities and research institutions. The Lancet Countdown on Health and Climate Change report says that impacts such as the severe heatwave seen in Europe and rising instances of deadly diseases, notably dengue fever in the tropics, are directly linked to climate change. The report lists food security, access to safe drinking water and clean air as other basic human rights that climate change affects. As an example of the associated economic impacts and challenges, the report cites that 153 billion hours of work were lost in 2017 due to extreme heat, 80% of it in agriculture. Human rights, specifically labour rights, in the apparel and footwear sector are the subject of the latest in Know the Chain's benchmark series released this week. Analysing the 43 leading sector brands, Know the Chain found that Adidas, Lululemon and Gap were the best performers. And all of the companies that had previously been benchmarked in 2016 had improved in some way in the 2018 version. However, there is still a lot to do. Half of the brands have no public policy to stop employers from taking worker passports. And the benchmark suggests little progress has been made on the key issue of responsible recruitment, with the apparel and footwear sector hugely reliant on migrant workers that are still subject to recruiter fees, leading to bonded labour and restrictions on free movement. 18 companies scored zero on their recruitment policies. The companies that scored best in the benchmark were those that have moved away from using employment agencies, preferring to recruit and employ workers directly. Luxury brands Prada and Salvatore Ferragamo were among the lowest scoring brands, alongside footwear companies Skechers and Foot Locker. In terms of the apparel sector's impact on climate change, however, the launch of a new UN fashion industry charter is perhaps better news. Due to be formally launched next week by designer Stella McCartney to coincide with the Katowice climate talks, signatories to the charter include a number of fast fashion brands, which are, of course, responsible for the lion's share of the sector's impacts. The move follows up research from fashion search engine List that, as we highlighted recently, provides evidence for sustainability and ethical choices from younger consumers when making purchases. Finally, while it does feel like it's taken some time to get onto the statute books, late last week the Australian Modern Slavery Act was finally passed by the country's parliament and is set to become law on 1st of January 2019. Based on the equivalent UK legislation, companies with turnover greater than $100 million Australian dollars, around $73 million US, will be required to outline modern slavery risks in operations and supply chains and state the actions they are taking to address those risks. More legislation is, of course, set to follow elsewhere. Do check out Innovation Forum's 2019 conference programme and get the dates into your diary. The new event series includes conferences on the future for food, apparel supply chains, modern slavery, climate change, and the developing bioeconomy. And sign up before 7th December this week to save up to $800 at the launch discount rate to register for Innovation Forum's Future of Food conferences on 21st and 22nd May 2019 in Chicago, and also on the 4th and 5th of June in London. Among those already signed up to participate are experts from PepsiCo, Mondelez, Syngenta, World Cocoa Foundation, Kellogg, AB InBev, Walgreens Boots Alliance, and many others. I hope you can join us in Chicago or London next spring. Interview time now. In Detroit at Innovation Forum's Impact Measurement and Return on Investment for Sustainability event, I interviewed General Motors Sustainability Director David Chulauskas. Okay, we've been talking a little bit around in assessing just now General Motors and how you're working on your sustainability and the impacts that your programs are having. I noticed on the email conversation that we were having ahead of the session that at the bottom you have GM's ambitions, which are zero crashes, zero emissions, and zero congestion. These are quite serious ambitions. How are you going to achieve them?
So that is the vision of the future that we see. We are motivated to get there because our customers don't want to get into accidents. Our customers want to leave a better planet for their children. Our customers don't want to be wasting their time in traffic. It's very much customer driven and a recognition that we've got an opportunity. Our industry is changing more than it has in the last 100 years. We're in a period of time where we're either going to be disrupted or we're the disruptors. We've chosen to be the disruptors, and we're working toward a future of, as you mentioned, zero crashes, zero emissions, zero congestion. We believe we can get there because it's really built around four key technologies and approaches. So one is autonomous technology. We already have nearly 200 autonomous vehicles being tested on the road today, and we've made a commitment to launch a commercially viable autonomous ride-sharing business next year. Connected. Vehicles are more connected than ever today. They're connected to our customers. Even when they're not even in the vehicle, they're connected to infrastructure. They're connected to other vehicles. Electrified. We're fully committed to electrifying our fleet. We've got 13 vehicles around the world today that are plug-in electric vehicles, and we've made a commitment to bring out another 20 between now and 2023. And then the sharing economy, ride sharing, car sharing, really built around our Maven brand, is influencing consumer behavior, and it's meeting their needs and their convenience, and it's giving cities an opportunity to rethink transportation from a systems approach. The first mile, last mile is often a barrier using rapid and mass transit systems. Autonomous, connected, electrified, and shared vehicles can help address that last mile, first mile dilemma right now. So this has an opportunity not only to transform our business, but transform the cities and the communities in which our customers live, as well as transform our operations and our supply chain. And that's what we're working on.
Sure. Quite big claims to say that your customers want to go zero emissions and prepare to car share. That's a big change from the typical model of everyone buying a two-car, petroleum-driven car family. What market research have you got that proves this point?
I don't have any specific market research off the top of my head, but anecdotally, in 2015, I think Uber and Lyft rides in New York City surpassed yellow taxi rides. You're seeing that everywhere around the world, that ride sharing services are being readily adopted and used by consumers all over the world.
The move towards electric vehicles, that's something else that you're confident that your consumers really want that?
I'm confident that consumers that get in electric vehicles and they quickly realize that one, it can meet a majority of their daily driving needs, and two, they're just fun to drive. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're quick off the line. They've got instant torque, which provides great acceleration. They've got a great center of gravity that's low to the ground because of the battery that provides great handling, and they're quiet. So our customer feedback, once we get them, we call it butts in seats. Once we get their butts in the seat, they are sold. But there's still a lot of public awareness. There's still a lot of concerns about range and charging infrastructure that we need to overcome. But you can see month after month, year after year, electric vehicle sales are increasing. It's slow, but Rome wasn't created in a day. For us, the future is electric. We don't exactly know when we're going to get there, but we know that that's where we're headed.
To get towards zero emissions, I guess two things. First of all, you have to convince your customers that electric vehicles are the way to go, and you have to then have a charging infrastructure which enables them to get around. And also, you then have to work with the utilities so that the power that your consumers are using to charge their vehicles is not being generated in a coal-fired power station. So how do you engage beyond your immediate sphere of influence? How do you engage with others in the industry to develop a charging infrastructure and also to change the utilities, to change the grid?
So partnerships and policy are going to be key to really ensuring an accelerated and successful penetration, if you will, of electric vehicles. Partnerships, things like the Renewable Energy Buyers Association is a coalition of businesses, nonprofits. It first started out with a development of a set of renewable buyers principles that we shared with public utility commissions that really set the rules and guidelines for the utilities operating in certain districts. We created them to provide guidance to developers and financiers to do these projects in ways that can drive efficiencies, consistency, and reduce risks of using renewable energy. Business has said, we have the demand. We'll provide the demand. Now you guys supply it. So we work together to come with a compelling demand signal for renewables at an industrial scale. What a great place to start to take that to a utility scale in a standardized, consistent way. Once that happens, the greener the grid is, the more value there is from driving zero emission vehicles because of just what you said. That's a key strategic priority for us. And we've also internally made a commitment to use 100% renewable energy for all of our facilities by 2050. By the end of this year, globally, 20% of our electricity use will come from renewable energy sources.
Sure. And I guess in terms of really pushing the electrical vehicle side, that becomes a differentiator for your business because some of your competitors in the US aren't really going down the electrical vehicles route. They are still sticking to the, you know, developing better petroleum-driven cars. So is that something you're using as a real differentiator for your business?
Again, consumers love getting in these vehicles. They love how they drive. They love how they handle. But they also love utility. They love the flexibility that certain vehicle sizes and configurations give. So the challenge is being the best at meeting all of your customers' expectations at the lowest cost. So whether it's a car, a truck, SUV, it is great competing with a lot of formidable other OEMs, and it is a great time to be in our industry. I mean, sure. It's changing so fast. So a lot of fun, a lot of choices out there for our customers, and we're driven to provide them the best vehicles.
Let's talk a little bit about your supply chain impacts and challenges. It seems to me that there are two in particular of interest right now. There's the, if we are talking about lots more electric vehicles, there's a lot of concerns around the use of conflict minerals, rare earth metals, and the battery in the motors. How are you dealing with that?
Yeah. One is within the automotive industry, where there are opportunities to collaborate in non-competitive areas, we absolutely are doing that. And so many aspects of our complex tiered supply chain provides great opportunities for collaboration. There's a lot of key minerals, materials, commodities that we use that have a number of concerns with them, whether they be deforestation, human rights concerns, unethical business practices. So as an industry, we've established a set of guiding principles that have been signed, if you will, by 11 automakers from Japan, Korea, Europe, US, that have really established our set of expectations for our supply chain. We're also collaborating with our supply chain as well as other industries, the electronics industry, for example, with the Responsible Materials Initiative, where there is a specific working group focused on cobalt. Cobalt is a key mineral that goes into cathodes for lithium ion batteries. And it, the largest source of that comes from an area in Africa where there's a lot of conflict. And you may be familiar with the term conflict minerals. While cobalt is not considered a quote unquote conflict mineral, it still is operating in the same environment where there are artisanal mines that may be using various forms of labor that don't meet our expectations, which may be funding and practicing unethical business issues. So we need to get in there. On conflict minerals, we've got a smelter initiative to create certified smelters that can help drive transparency and traceability into these material value chains. It's really hard. It's going to take all of us, and it's going to take other stakeholders such as governments and NGOs to partner together to really address this.
It must be a real challenge to collaborate around sourcing some minerals and elements that are hard to find, the rare earth metals and so on. Surely it must be a big part of a competitive advantage to have security of supply there. So how are you collaborating internally with others in the industry to work around that to ensure that everyone has a security of supply?
Yeah. What came to mind is a couple options we have. So take conflict minerals, for example. We don't want to no longer source from some of these countries. We just want to make sure we're doing business with the right people in those countries so we don't unintentionally damage the economy. So pulling out is not necessarily the right solution. However, in some instances, you'd mentioned rare earth metals. You know, in some instances, we can achieve the same performance by moving to different materials and minerals. And in those instances, we may want to just totally design out to avoid the issues altogether. In other areas, for example, in rubber, the automotive industry uses 75% of the world's rubber. We own this. There are concerns of deforestation, human rights, and unethical business practices in the rubber value chain. Rubber, 90% of it comes from Southeast Asia, so it's very concentrated, but it's providing a livelihood to an estimated 6 million people. So we've got an opportunity to really transform the rubber value chain to avoid and ultimately eliminate deforestation, human rights abuses, and unethical business practices while helping to raise standards of living of 6 million people that depend on this important commodity. We were working with a global NGO that really brought to our attention the opportunities we had to drive a transformative change in the value chain. We partnered with four of our key tire manufacturers, Bridgestone, Goodyear, Continental, and Michelin. Collectively, we made a commitment that we were only going to source tires with sustainable natural rubber. What does that mean? How do we have the assurance that we're going to achieve that? I mean, none of those things are in place. That's where the collaboration comes in. We've now are working with the World Business Council on Sustainable Development, specifically the tire industry project called TIP. TIP has 11 tire manufacturers that represent 65% of the world's tire production. You've got now a number of OEMs that are seriously considering this. We're absolutely committed to this. We are taking a value chain approach. So just in February, there was a team representing tire engineering, purchasing, and sustainability from three different countries, US, Thailand, and China from General Motors, went, and we basically went to every key aspect of the value chain. So the person that sources nearly 50 million tires a year is learning how to tap a rubber tree from a tapper on a small plantation. And it's going to be a challenge. It's going to be complex. But working with NGOs, working with technology providers, we are confident that we can get to the level of transparency and traceability in this value chain that is going to really help us to maximize the value that this commodity provides to livelihoods by, for example, increasing yields rather than expanding their footprint, if you will. That can ultimately drive efficiencies for us and a higher confidence in the product. And then hopefully consumers recognize the benefit to them in an alignment with their value.
And what can the rubber sector learn from other deforestation commodities? I mean, obviously, cocoa we heard from yesterday, the Cocoa Life Initiative from Bondelez, and there's the Cocoa in the Forest Initiative in Ghana and Cote d'Ivoire. Palm oil, obviously, never out of the headlines. So it strikes me that the rubber sector has got a chance to really learn from these other commodities and really make sure they can have a sustainable future. Is that something that the industry recommends?
Absolutely. One of the early sort of learnings was we need to take a value chain approach, and all stakeholders need to have an opportunity to provide input and contribute to the decision-making. So I'm confident that very soon there'll be more public information about how this is all coming together. But that early learning from benchmarking other sort of commodity-based solutions helped inform how we're establishing a governance structure that provides opportunities for the entire value chain and all the stakeholders to have a say in how we move forward, what the protocols are, metrics, requirements, et cetera.
Sure. I think certainly the rubber supply chain is something that's going to be very interesting to keep an eye on over the next few years. But for now, David Chulauskas from General Motors, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Ian.
Following Innovation Forum's recent business and human rights conference in London, I caught up with Unseen CEO Andrew Wallace. Why don't you start by giving us a bit of background on Unseen's work and how through that you're seeing modern slavery risks evolving?
Sure. So Unseen is an anti-slavery and trafficking charity, and we do five main things. So we work with survivors that are identified in the UK through the National Referral Mechanism. So that's men, women and children. And that encompasses everything from safe house accommodation through to outreach work, through to helping survivors reintegrate back into society or return safely to their countries of origin if they have to. We work with all the major blue light agencies around awareness raising, training and joint operations, and ensuring that they remain victim focused during those operations. We work with corporates around the issues that they're facing, not only in terms of having to comply with legislation that is here in the UK, but developing around the globe, but how they can take a proactive stance in terms of tackling modern slavery. We work with governments, local, devolved, national, and increasingly internationally around legislation, policy, and strategy. And we run the UK's Modern Slavery Helpline. So I think we're unique in that space in that we sort of have that frontline experience and we take that experience and that knowledge in order to inform all the other parts of our work. So we're not theorists, we're practitioners that are then saying, you know, here are the issues that are being faced. How do we resolve these issues? And we're also in that privileged position that we're one of the key data stakeholders because of the information that we get through the helpline and because of the information that we gather from survivors through our services to really start to understand some of the granular detail of what's really going on around modern slavery. You know, the typology, the prevalence, recruitment methodologies, control methodologies, and all of that enables us to speak with authority and with facts about what's actually happening.
Thinking of the companies you work with, you say you work with them and help them to take a proactive stance in modern slavery. What do you think is the right sort of proactive stance that companies need to take?
As an overall arching thing, I think companies fall into sort of two camps. So I think there are companies that sort of have the stance of, well, if this happens, then we'll do X, Y, and Z, or we'll start to think about X, Y, and Z. Whereas for me, a proactive company is saying, well, when this happens. So there is an expectation that all companies are touched by this. And so they're then saying, okay, well, proactively, how do we understand where it's going on? How are we going to find it and uncover it? How are we going to educate our staff? How are we going to educate our supply chains to both recognize it, report it? You know, what does remediation look like? What does restitution look like? That to me is a proactive stance that companies need to have at the start. In terms of the specifics of what we do everything from, we have a business hub that is linked to the helpline where we can help businesses understand, given where your footprint is, and this is initially in the UK, but we want to expand this internationally, given where your footprint is in the UK, if you share that information with us, we can begin to do a number of things. One, we can tell you straight away if we're getting any reports, wherever you've got a touch point, but also we can help you understand what is going on in that geographical location. Because I think one of the trends that we've seen, and this directly relates to companies, is that the exploitation isn't always necessarily within the factory or within the immediate premises of that business. It's off-site. And so it's then very difficult to know how to tackle that. And so I think you need to understand that bigger geographical picture. We then have a number of other packages. One is around a continuous improvement program. So again, for those companies that have got a stance of, we really want to, you know, be at the forefront of this and leaning into this, how across about 14, 15, 16 different criteria, how those companies are doing things. So it's all very well for a company to say, well, we train staff. But then that begs the question of, well, how do you train? How do you understand what the impact of that is and the understanding of that? And what results does that lead to? And then what does that then drive you forward to? And then we have software that's aimed at the sort of the SME market or those within a larger company's supply chain, which helps them manage and think through all the different issues that they need to think through when it comes to tackling modern slavery.
How do you think attitudes are changing? I mean, are the public and businesses ready to acknowledge that the sort of modern slavery risks that you work to counter in the UK are real? I mean, do people accept that there's modern slavery in the UK?
I think at the general sort of public level, I think that there is definitely, you know, if we look back over the last 10 years, there's definitely been a growth in terms of an understanding and awareness of these issues. In terms of an acceptance, it's very difficult to say sort of where that is. You know, I still think you can vox pop on the street and you will get a myriad of answers as to what modern slavery is, and then you'll get a different set of answers as to whether that happens here. The Royal College of Holloway just released a report, you know, looking at what's consumer understanding of this issue. I think, you know, if you want one of the headlines that screams out from it is people still think it's a problem that happens overseas and not happens here. But we certainly know from national referral mechanism data that, you know, UK citizens are the fifth most populous in terms of number of victims. There's still an awareness raising that needs to go on. There still needs to be that perception shift that people go, yes, it does happen. It happens here. It happens overseas. And then there still needs to be that connection for the public, in that there is a real direct connection between the goods and the services that I purchase, given the globalized nature of business these days, that my lifestyle means that I have a touch point with people that are in forced labor exploitation. In terms of businesses, again, it's mixed. And I think we see this in terms of the response to the legislation, you know, where we've just had over 50% of those 18,000 organizations that should be filing a report every year. It's just over the halfway point in terms of compliance, just around creating a report. And then I think when you look into the quality of those reports, they're variable, but actually, it's kind of like missing the point. The report should be the icing on the cake and should be a report of all the steps that businesses are taking. And it's back to this when, if. And I think if you've got a when mentality, you don't have to argue that this is going on. It's actually, okay, I need to look at my businesses for where it's there. And then for those really leading edge companies, it's asking those tough questions of, does the system in which I'm operating, i.e. an extractive profit model, actually enable exploitation to take place? And what does it look like to transition to a much more sustainable profit model, which means we can address those issues and ensure things like decent work all the way through the supply chain in order that we reduce our vulnerabilities to this type of exploitation?
Certainly a trend that needs to happen for businesses is a move towards transparency in operations and supply chains so that modern slavery risks become clear. What trends are you seeing around transparency from business?
I think there is an acceptance that transparency is sort of a slow-moving tsunami that is sweeping the globe. And so I suppose the first question for business is to say, well, are you going to try and ride this wave, or are you going to be sort of King Canute and try and ignore it? And that didn't work out too well for King Canute, and I don't think it will work out well for businesses. Specifically, what we're seeing is a willingness to understand that, I suppose, there's been a generational shift and there's been a technological shift. So generationally, the millennials and Generation Z are sort of the first true global citizens. They understand and think much more on a global level. Secondly, that they want answers around the environment, sustainability, slavery, and then they want this alignment between their value system and the value system of the company that they're working for. And if there's a disconnect, they either don't even approach that business in terms of potential employer, or they leave that business looking for that alignment. So I think the societal shifts that are taking place, and businesses have to be cognizant of that. They have to react to that. Otherwise, they're consigning themselves to either subpar performance or not being able to attract the brightest and the best, or at worst, you get the consumer just moving away from it. So I think there are some big sort of tectonic plates that are moving at the moment. We're in an interesting sort of point in history around that. And I think allied to that, the purchasing power that the millennials and Generation Z and the generations behind them, I think they're beginning to understand that, you know, consumer activism has a role to play. And there's a sort of neat historical parallel here in terms of sort of the transatlantic slave trade. It was actually consumers who decided we're not going to engage with those businesses that are involved in the slave trade that brought those business leaders to that point of, well, if we don't change, if we don't acquiesce with public opinion on this, we're going out of business. There's not a direct parallel, but it's interesting how that activism level is going. Now, add into that the ability of technology and social media to amplify that, and everybody as a journalist, it's very difficult for businesses to hide things because everybody can report. And so actually, you're in a much stronger position if you're willing to talk about these things and even talk about, well, here are incidences that we've found, and this is what we've learned from it, and this is how we're applying it, and we don't agree this is right, and this is restitution that we made. I'm much more drawn to those businesses. My view is that you're taking this seriously and you want to engage with this. And so what I think the transparency thing is forcing businesses to think about is that they have to be able to demonstrate and evidence what they're doing, not just say, as one business leader said to me the other day, not unicorn paint, this nice rosy sort of report about, you know, best intentions. It's actually, let's have the hard, gritty details of what they're doing, the problems that they're encountering, and how they're going to sort of try and work through those issues in order to ensure decent work, in order to ensure that forced labor exploitation and child, the worst forms of child labor exploitation, are not in their business or within the remit of their business.
You're right. It does feel that there's a definite consumer engagement angle here. And this is something that tech consumers really do get engaged on. Thinking forward then, how does this all play out? What's the route to eliminating slavery in operations and supply chains for business? And what do you want companies to do more of better to get there?
I think you're seeing a slew of legislation starting to work its way around the globe. And so actually, I think there's going to be that legislative expectation that this is just becomes business norm. It needs to become normal to evidence what you're doing to combat these issues and report what you found. And I would actually argue, you know, if there was to be a change in legislation, I would make it compulsory for businesses to report every time they find an instance of modern slavery and then report what they've done about it all the way through to remediation and restoration. So I think legislation is one bit. The consumer activism piece that we've already talked about is another bit. And this modern slavery issue is just one of a number of issues around which for them it's an issue of due diligence within that company. If you're not taking this issue seriously, then it's raising issues around, well, actually, how seriously do you take the whole due diligence process, the whole attitude around risk? Then another one is, and I think this is where forward leading companies are going, is, but actually this is a really positive opportunity. This is about positioning within the marketplace. This is about recognizing that societal shift and where do we want to be as a company. And I think coming back to sort of some of the B-team philosophy that the Paul Pullmans, the Bransons and others that have sort of created B-team, which is to say business should be a force for social good. And I think those businesses that recognize that are going to reap the rewards in the coming years. As to your second question as to what do I want to see businesses doing, I want them to report, be telling us what they're actually doing, warts and all. We all know this is going on. We all know this is one of the consequences of rapid globalization over the last 30 or 40 years, that we need to have a level of correction now, and people want to know. And I think the companies that don't tell us, then actually the question should be then, well, what are you hiding in that whole process? And you need the legislation piece in order to create the level playing field. Legislation does need to be backed up with action if you're not in compliance with the law. You need the investors to go, well, if you're not telling us we've got concerns, you know, we're potentially going to de-invest. You need the consumer to say, actually, I want to do these things. We also need to myth bust, you know, by applying the principles of decent work and a contextualized living wage all the way down the supply chains. Prices are not going to rocket. They are going to go up a little. But actually, do I want to consume at the expense of a fellow human being? Most people don't when they're faced with that choice, but they need to understand, you know, and that needs to be explained to them. And that's the role of business, to re-educate the customer in all of that. So I think that there's lots more to do, but I think those companies that are willing to risk saying what they're actually doing and what they're actually finding will actually discover that they will win the confidence of consumers, investors, and other businesses that they want to do business with because they're being transparent.
I mean, I think you're right. Encouraging companies to take a warts and all approach and on disclosure is really counterintuitive for so many. So it's taking a real attitude change in business or many sectors of business to develop the right approach. Listeners, Andrew is a regular expert panelist at Innovation Forum's Modern Slavery Conferences. So do look out for details of what's to come in 2019. But for now, Andrew Wallace, CEO of Unseen, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you very much.
Don't forget to sign up this week to get the best price on passes to Innovation Forum's Future of Food conferences in May and June, using, of course, the exclusive podcast for the discount code IFPOD10. And do check out the rest of the Innovation Forum 2019 events calendar and get those dates in your diary. But that's it for now. I've been Ian Welsh, and I'll be back next week. Until then, goodbye.